Morning. How are you? We have one case scheduled for oral argument this morning, and we understand both counsel have appeared, announced ready, so we'll call that case now. Guillermo Lugo versus the state.
Next, please report. Mr. Richard Henderson will argue for appellant. Ms. Shelley Netherly will argue for the state.
Morning, honors. This case, I've described it when I first went over the record, started going over the record, reminds me of a bad prize fight or maybe one of those athletic events you go to and both sides don't play very well and somebody wins and they call it winning ugly. It may be reflective of the facts in this case, which were kind of definitely a sordid scene. You've got a seedy motel room. Mr. Lugo is living there, apparently selling drugs in the shadows of the transaction that eventually ensues, that made several transactions. Are some ladies who apparently are there under the influence of drugs and doing whatever else, I do not know. Ladies that have never been interviewed by the police and no one's ever seen them, witnesses that I think many people would like to have talked to. You've got the star witness who shows up, I think, to deliver more drugs and collect a payment. And finally, of course, you have the deceased who shows up apparently going through withdrawal and needing some cocaine very badly. What ensues thereafter, of course, is a matter of some dispute. Just to say briefly, there are some conflicts in the evidence and the testimony of the supposed star witness. Apparently, the deceased dies of direct force trauma, meaning that apparently the gun was placed up to his back because of powder burns. And, of course, in the star witness indicates that he was shot from a few feet away. After the shooting, nobody sticks around to talk to the police. The only human being left in the hotel room is the deceased when they finally get there. The investigation stalls for several months, if I recall, maybe even a year or more, and after which Mr. Lugo was found in a state up in the north, I think it was Ohio. The detective comes to interview him, and the bad prize fight continues. If you look at the transcription of the interview that the detective did of Mr. Lugo, just rambles on and on and on. And while it was introduced for the record only, ultimately, it was never introduced into the trial in chief of the case. What I'm here to at least point out to the court and at least discuss is what we believe is potential error in the case, or is error in the case, is the confession, or at least what remnants of it were introduced into the record. There was a motion to suppress filed and a hearing held outside of the jury. That is also a rather confused section of the record as to see what's going on, what they're agreeing to. Apparently, they're going to agree to redact some of it, leave some of it in. Of course, it had to be translated and certified to by a certified translator because the entire statement itself was taken in Spanish. Again, though, once they got to the end of the motion to suppress, the detective was called. And he testified to some, what I would call, custodial statements made by Mr. Lugo, but the statement itself is never introduced. And what we are left with is some statements by the detective, which apparently establish that Mr. Lugo lied about not being there and then later on saying that he was there, which establishes his presence, and to some other inconsistencies. But if the confession itself is really not specifically introduced, but it appears to be a violation of Texas Code of Criminal Procedure 3822 to introduce any custodial statements that Mr. Lugo is making. Because 3822 states that confessions will be electronically recorded or written down, and there's a number of other checklists of things that have to be followed in order to introduce any custodial statements made. The argument, I guess, could be made by the state is that since there was no objection and since the statement didn't come in, it was just a few, almost an impeachment of Mr. Lugo, that there's no foul. But there were statements made by him, brought in, introduced by the detective who interviewed him in Ohio. And as I would state that, again, there was no objection by counsel at trial. I guess I would have to say, you know, I went to some great CLE last week where the topic came up of whether or not unobjected to error, was there any difference in that and unassigned error. We certainly believe that 3822 was not followed. We believe that that evidence should have been suppressed as part of the motion to suppress, but I'm not sure there's ever any findings made under the motion to suppress.
Well, if there are no findings and there was a motion to suppress, aren't we required to abate for findings and conclusions?
Possibly so, Your Honor. But
the prosecutor...
There was no objection in the record about it, and I don't know, as I say, it was kind of a bad prize fight. I'm not exactly sure what the state would be there, Your Honor, but perhaps to send it back for findings. But essentially, the statement itself, you've got to, and the court reporter very clearly states that it was admitted for the record only. It was never admitted into the case in chief before the jury. So in a sense, it was in a sense granted, at least to the big overall statement, but they let the detective testify to a few things.
But was it as impeachment to rebut?
Looks like evidence in chief. It doesn't say it's impeachment. I think the...
Well, if it came in during the... I mean, that was one of the first witnesses to testify, wasn't it?
Well, then later on, he's brought back after the motion to suppress, and he's put on, I think, right before the state rests. He basically testifies that he denied being present in the motel when the shot was fired, when he was. So, I don't know. As I say, there was a lot made about the statement, but it was actually officially never introduced, and the only things that came in that Mr. Lugo said were his denial that he'd ever been there, and I remember there may have been one more issue.
Well, did anybody sign a waiver? The state claims waiver, and of course in criminal law, waiver requires an affirmative act.
There was no waiver. There was no waiver that I guess they would say, since it was unobjected to, that it essentially waived.
Well, it wasn't just unobjected to. Didn't trial counsel say himself that he thought the statement would be or was admissible under 3822? Or?
I don't remember that, Judge. If he did, I've
quoted in the state's brief.
I don't recall that, and I don't know that that's what he – I mean, I just don't know, Your Honor. I mean,
the reporter's record, volume 3, page 228.
What page of the state's brief is that, Your Honor?
Page 20. Page 20.
It appears to me that they're saying they're involuntary. He says that they were involuntary statements.
So he doesn't raise the 3822 challenge. He raises essentially a Fifth and Sixth Amendment challenge.
Right.
Is that
right?
Anyway, as I said, I wish they'd made it a little clearer. I'm running a little bit out of time since I've said I wouldn't take all of the time, but I would point out that I'd like to go to issue 5 with regard to the old, I think they were also talking about this old DWI conviction that was admitted. They thought was under an old third under 1244A, which in fact back in, you have to know what was really happened in that conviction, you have to be old and to practice law back when the DWI law was in Article 6701 of the Transportation Code, and it listed both what amounted to misdemeanor punishment and felony punishment in the same statute. It was not a 1244A reduction. But our argument is that you can't tell on its face of the conviction whether or not it was for a misdemeanor, since it equaled misdemeanor punishment at that time. It does say DWI, felony repetition, but it does not say that it was a felony DWI. And we think that makes it ambiguous. We've quoted Burkhalter, and that's very important to the case, because without that second conviction, my client is not a habitual criminal, and the minimum punishment is not 25 years. It would be 15 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Ms. Messerly?
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court. If you don't mind, I'd just like to start with addressing a few of the questions that you addressed to co-counsel. And Justice Casey, as to your question regarding appellant's statement in the record, appellant did make a statement in the record after regarding 3822 after at the end of the motion to suppress hearing, and he affirmatively said, "The only point I would make," and I'm reading from the record, "and I'm not going to argue with the court's ruling, is I think that 3822 questions a different question from the constitutional law question. I didn't base my motion on 3822. I think the statement would be admissible under 3822, but the objection I'm making is a constitutional one." So, and Justice Dofano, as to your questions, there were some findings. The court did make findings of fact as to the voluntariness of the statement, but there was no request for findings of fact on the 3822. It just wasn't an issue during the motion to suppress hearing. Now, later, when Detective Reyes testified about his interview with appellant in Ohio, at that time, as you know, Mr. Henderson said, appellant never raised a 3822 objection.
So we have procedural default, not waiver. Waiver in a criminal law requires an affirmative act by the defendant himself.
Okay. I would submit that his statement at the end of the suppression hearing that it was admissible under 382 would substantiate an affirmative act.
What about, though, well, that's the lawyer, that's not the defendant. Only the defendant can waive things in criminal law. Okay, this is my problem. 3822 says no fit statement of a defendant will come in unless it's in writing or recorded and witnesses identified, and
yes, okay. I'm aware.
So, but you're saying a statement that was taken down and was recorded can come in without showing it was taken down and without showing it was recorded if defense counsel specifically says, "I am not challenging it under 3822, there's no obligation to comply with 3822?
No, and I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. Actually, under 3822, as you just said, there's, I think, five requirements that have to be met in order for a defendant's statement to come in.
Right.
And if you look at the record, every single one of those requirements were met, and that is discussed in the record. The prosecutor asked Detective Reyes before he testified, you know, was it recorded? Did you advise him of his rights? Was the recording accurate? Are all the voices on the CD recording identified? And there was absolutely no complaint. In fact, the appellant, his attorney agreed that they had received the CD recording and the transcript in a timely manner. So all that is in the record.
Yeah, but my question obviously wasn't artfully phrased.
No, perhaps I just misunderstood.
Does the statement itself have to come in the form that complies with the statute, or can they just say, yeah, the statement is out there in a form that complies with the statute, and now let's talk about it? I mean, there was an old rule that you couldn't talk about a document that was not admitted into evidence. And so the statement is a document because it's either going to be an oral document or it's going to be a written document. So can you talk about a document that is not actually admitted into evidence?
I understand what you're saying. And I'll be honest with you, I have spent so much time researching this issue specifically as to 3822. I looked at every single annotation in Westlaw that I could find trying to get an answer to that exact question. I couldn't find any cases that said or didn't say that you actually had to admit the document, the recording, the writing in order to discuss the statement. I couldn't find anything that answered that question either way.
Okay.
And I looked quite extensively, and I couldn't find anything to answer that question. I will also remind you that in this particular case, the state did talk to the detective and elicited answers about the, you know, the statement that the appellant gave in Ohio. But the defense attorney did the same thing. In fact, at one point in the record, the defense attorney reads from the actual statement and asks the detective questions about it too. And at no time in the record did the defendant or the defendant's attorney, I'm sorry, ask that that statement be admitted. At no time did the court say, no, we will not admit, you know, the recording or the statement in.
No, I think it was incumbent on defense counsel to object to discussion of a document that wasn't in evidence.
And that objection was never made. So.
And that was the primary evidence against the defendant, right, his own statement?
You know what? I would disagree with you on that, really. And if you, I discuss that a bit in my brief, really all that the state really got from that statement was that he was in the room at the time that the murder occurred. He never admitted in that statement that he committed the murder. But we had Mrs. Sanchez, who testified that she was in the room, that she saw the appellant holding a gun, that she saw the victim on his knees, that as she turned to walk to the door, she heard a shooting, she heard a gun go off. She turns around, she sees the appellant holding the gun right at the victim, and he's falling forward. So we had that testimony, but that's not all we had. We had some DNA tests that were admitted that showed that his DNA, the appellant's, was in the motel room at the time of the shooting. We also had some testimony from an officer regarding items that they found in the motel room, such as pay stubs that had the appellant's name on it for a particular roofing company, and the officer verified that the appellant did indeed work for that roofing company. We also had testimony that from Sanchez that she saw the appellant and the victim, fighting over what she believed to be a .38 revolver. And we had testimony from a lab technician that the bullet that was found in the victim was a .38 caliber gun. So I would submit to you and argue that what we got from that statement wasn't really kind of the gist and the thrust of our case. All we got was that he was in the room at the time, and we already knew that. I mean, we had other testimony proving that. So let me just move on to the fifth issue. This is the issue that Mr. Henderson was discussing with you about appellant's prior conviction for the DWI. And if you look at the judgment, I think it's Exhibit 30, State's Exhibit Number 30, if you look at the judgment, it says felony. Well, let me make sure that I'm correct on that, and I read it to you exactly how it's worded. It says driving while intoxicated and felony rep. There's nothing on there to suggest that this was a misdemeanor conviction. Now, I agree with Mr. Henderson. At the time, under that civil statute, the way the legislature set it up is you had punishment for a misdemeanor DWI, you had punishment for a felony, but the two had some overlap there. There was some overlapping punishment that the jury or the trial court could assess that would qualify for misdemeanor or for felony. And as it so happens in this case, appellant's punishment was 6 months, which fell in that overlapping gap. I would argue to you, simply because it fell in that overlapping gap, which is what the legislature intended to be an option.
What was that conviction in?
I think it was in 92. 92 or 93.
What court?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was in Criminal District Court Number 4. Judge Drago was the judge.
And what year was that? 92?
That was in 93. May 10th, 93. That was the date of judgment, but I believe the offense was in 92.
Well, since that's a district court, that would indicate that it was a felony conviction. And
I agree.
Some of the district courts didn't have misdemeanor jurisdiction back in 92 and 93. You'd have to look at the enabling statute. I think CDC 4 did, but the 213th did not. Well, did not in the early 80s until it was changed. So if there was no concurrent jurisdiction, that would be certainly an indication. But the fact that it's in district court itself is indication that it was at least indicted, if there's indictment or an information.
We just have the judgment, Your Honor, here in the record. I just would argue again that appellant seems to be arguing to me that any time under that particular statute, that civil statute, a defendant received that punishment that fell in that kind of overlapping range, that would convert the level of the offense from a felony to a misdemeanor. And I don't think that's what the legislature intended with that. So I would also argue that under the penal code at that time, I think it's 1241, the penal code said any offenses that are not, that a person receives a conviction for that are not included in this penal code are defined as such. And under number one in that statute, it says if a person is convicted for an offense where penitentiary time is possible, that's a third degree felony. And we know, and Mr. Henderson included this in his brief as well, that the felony punishment for felony DWI under the civil statute was possibly up to 5 years in the penitentiary. Admittedly, the appellant didn't get that. He got 6 months. But there was a possibility that he could serve up to 5 years in the penitentiary.
And there's no indication of 1244A or 1244B?
There was no indication of that at the time. And if you look at Burkholder says to determine if 1244 was applicable or if it had been utilized, you look to see if a felony conviction was entered and then the trial court, there has to be some evidence the trial court found it was in the best interest of justice to actually, I'm not using the right language, but to actually kind of take that felony conviction away, enter a misdemeanor conviction, and enter misdemeanor punishment.
You just do it under 1244A or 1244B, depending on whether you're reducing to misdemeanor or just misdemeanor punishment. But
right.
It would say so on the judgment.
And there's just no evidence of that on the judgment. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but there's no evidence on the judgment at all. Burkholder, what happened in Burkholder is the appellant was indicted for felony assault. Ultimately, the judgment reflected that he was convicted of misdemeanor assault, serious bodily injury. He received misdemeanor punishment. His argument on appeal is that because there was no evidence of serious bodily injury, that the evidence was legally sufficient to support his conviction. The court agreed. Later, the state tried to, well, this came up when the state was trying to use that as a prior felony conviction. And because there was no evidence that 1244 had been utilized, the court found, I mean, I don't think there was any ambiguity in that opinion. I think it's pretty clear that the Court of Criminal Appeals said, no, there's no evidence that 1244 was utilized here at all. There was nothing on the judgment to reflect it. So with that, I would just submit my brief to the court. And unless there's any questions, any? No? Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Henderson.
Well, I hope that my bad prize fight analogy has not overlapped or spilled over into our argument, and hopefully it won't in your opinion, but it's hard to tell what was going on, and it's not a very smooth record. And it extends even to the argument about the issue over whether this was a felony or misdemeanor. I would submit that a felony court has the jurisdiction to find somebody guilty of a lesser-included misdemeanor, even if the original indictment is for a felony and we're in felony court. What I see happening, what had happened here is that this punishment was within the range of both the misdemeanor law at the time and the felony law at the time. The question becomes is whether or not the judgment has any ambiguity to it. The thing it says simply is DWI-felony repetition, and it gives a punishment of 6 months that would have been allowable under both the misdemeanor and the felony statute. And where I think a Burkhalter is analogous here is that it's not absolutely clear as to whether he was found guilty of a felony or a misdemeanor. The other idea with 3822, I wanted to come back to that for a moment, is that I think Judge Duffino is correct, and perhaps it would be considered procedural default, but we would also argue that that could be unassigned error as well, to allow what essentially was testimony from the detective from the statement, which was never introduced. But as I said, that part of the record is extremely hard to deal with. I mean, my point that I would make is why it was important to try to suppress it. Is if they're wanting to introduce it, they must have something they want to do to show that Mr. Lugo was guilty. And so his first denial that he wasn't there and then that he's present, they're both trying to impeach him, and they're also trying to establish that he was there.
Mr. Henderson, what portion of 3822 do you contend was violated?
I think that they should have introduced the recorded or written statement itself. And by not putting that into the record, letting the detective testify from it, was a violation of 3822.
Now, there's nothing in 3822 that says you must introduce a properly obtained confession, is there?
Well, it says if we're going to introduce them into the record, there must be electronic. I guess you could argue that if it was recorded electronically and it was written, that's established, therefore we could let the detective testify from it.
Well, my question, though, is that there's no mandate that you have to use the properly obtained 3822 confession in the 3822 section itself, is there?
Well, I think the salutary language says in order to use statements in trial against a defendant, I hope I'm doing it correctly, it must be electronically